Ah, mmm. The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the May 31st, 2011 Sox Prospects Podcast. I'm here with Ian, Mellon, and Hatfield, and today we're going to talk about a couple of topics. First being the draft preview. The draft is coming up in less than a week, so we're going to cover some items on who we think that the Red Sox might pick, the picks that the Red Sox have, past history of and strategy of what the Red Sox have done in the past. And then we're going to cover just what's been going on in the system for the last month since our last podcast. Since our last podcast, we've been to a ton of games. Chris and Chris took a southern trip down to Salem and Greenville and got to see a bunch of games down there. We've also been to a bunch of games in Pawtucket and Portland since then. So we have a bunch of firsthand accounts to cover. To talk about what's happened in the last month, plus all the promotions and everything. So getting down to business on the first order of business is the draft preview. We have some decent ideas of where to go with who the Red Sox might be looking at, players that are projected to go in the places where the Red Sox will be picking and whatnot. So getting into it, I just kind of give you a little bit of information. The Red Sox are picking. The draft starts on Monday night. The Red Sox have four picks on day one, number 19 and 26 in the first round, number 36 and 40 in the supplemental round, and all of those are compensation picks for Victor Martinez and Adrian Beltre. They lost the 24th pick for signing Carl Crawford. And then on day two, they basically have the 21st selection in every round. They have 81st overall pick in the second round, 111th overall is their third round pick, and on and on. So the day two goes till round 30, and then day three is rounds 31 to 50. So day two is on Tuesday, and day three is on Wednesday. This is the third installment of our draft preview. Yesterday we brought you an installment on Red Sox recent history and draft strategy. On Tuesday we had the Red Sox preview introduction. Going forward, we're going to talk about players linked to the Red Sox, signability risks. We're going to have a first round mock draft, and on June 6th we'll bring you an installment on potential day one picks. So that's going to be our projections for the day one picks on the day of the day one. And just looking back, we've done a really good job to give ourselves a little pat on the back with projecting these types of things. In that installment last year, the first three players we listed were Colburn Vidic, Bryce Branson, Anthony Renato. Obviously, those are the first three players that the Red Sox selected. And we've had similar amounts of kind of luck projecting who the Red Sox might pick in past years. So let's talk about this year. 19th, 26th, 36th, 40th pick. Overall strategy, we got Ian here. He's our draft expert. We got Mellon and Hatfield. Just overall strategy, without getting into any particular players, what do you think that the Red Sox are going this year?
I guess a lot of the speculation before the draft has been that since this is the last year before the collective bargaining agreement might change the draft how as we know it, the Red Sox could splurge on this draft and potentially take, you know, $7 or $8 million prospects and just throw money at them. I don't know if that fits within their general principle of how they spend money and if that just deviates too far from that. But I think they still will they'll stick to that path of taking the best player available, diversifying talent between college, high school, position players and pitchers, and making sure that they've got, you know, all grounds covered.
I agree. Hatfield, what do you think?
Well, first off, I like to point out that I believe that we're not correctly predicting who the Red Sox are going to take. I like to think of it as we're they're listening to us and picking who we tell them to take. But no, I think Ian hit the nail right on the head. I don't see the Red Sox as a team that will deviate from their strategy because of a year like this one. That said, I could see things looking different because I think the strategy is to kind of diversify and maybe pick out, you know, maybe a market inefficiency, and that might be different this year than in years past, depending on how things fall. But, you know, the year we had last year aside, it's just so hard to figure out who's going to fall in a given year, especially given the way the MLB draft works, where it's not necessarily the best guy getting taken number one, the second best guy getting taken number two, the 19th best player falling to 19, and the 26th best player being taken at 26. It's really hard to figure out who might get to the Red Sox. That said, the draft is so deep this year that, you know, there's a player who would normally get taken in the top 10 fall to the Sox at, say, 26 and demand top 10 money. I mean, you know, one way you could justify it is in, yeah, last year they might have been top 10, but at the same time, this year is so deep that, you know, maybe they are legitimately a late first-round talent. So I'm kind of interested to see how that plays out. I mean, the types of players that we see falling or going to the Red Sox in the mock drafts strike me as guys that never would have fallen to them in past years. You know, there was always like, Vic's a good hitter, but he's a good college hitter. You know, the Brents had a great year as a sophomore, but he didn't do anything last year, et cetera.
The fortuitous thing for the Red Sox is that they, the top of the draft, which really was kind of the strength of the draft going in, has kind of fallen apart recently. Not fallen apart completely, because people still consider Rendon a great talent, and Gerrit Cole has a great arm and great potential, but those guys aren't the locks that they thought they were going into the draft. That said, the middle of the draft is as strong as we thought it was going in, if not stronger. And that's where the meat of the Red Sox picks it are.
So, yeah, at that 19 and 26, it just seems like we might be able to get guys that could be like top 10 talents in other years, just because that middle of that first round is so strong right now, and a few guys might slip due to signability. Mellon, I know that the draft isn't really your wheelhouse, but do you have any you want to put in your two cents on where you think that might happen compared to what's going on in recent years versus this year? What do you think?
Sure, I think they'll still stick with their basic overall strategy, as Ian said, of identifying the players with the best talent that they think fit, you know, into their philosophy and within the organization. And with four picks basically between 19 and 40, they knew going into this year that they were going to have an opportunity to reload the system, and that allowed them to, you know, trade off Kelly, Rizzo, and Raymond Fuentes to go get Adrian Gonzalez. I think, you know, they obviously had that in the back of their mind that they're going to be able to refill the system. You know, I'm not sure. I wouldn't know what names of the players they're going to target, but, you know, talking about the collective bargaining agreement, I don't think they're all of a sudden just going to sign people to these extravagant signing bonuses because, you know, that this is the last year, because they've been doing that. You know, some of the comments, you know, around from people within baseball, especially when I was down in fall instructs, was that just look at all these players that the Red Sox have been able to bring in, you know, Sean Coyle, Garen Cecchini, Renato, and look at their bonus numbers. Now, bonuses to me don't always represent talent, but the Red Sox have always been able to open the checkbook, and maybe Coyle wasn't regarded as a $1.3 million bonus player, and they could have paid him less, but they still open the checkbook, and they pay the extra couple hundred thousand dollars to get these guys, or the extra whatever. You know, they gave Lucas LeBlanc $600,000, you know, to sign. And I think what you might see is that in the recent seasons, you haven't really seen those late round big signings. You know, I've been looking through the draft history, and it seems like the last guy, I may not be 100% here, but the last guy that they drafted real late and signed to a pretty big bonus was Drake Britton in the 23rd round in 2007. You know, they signed Britton to a $700,000 bonus, and they really haven't done that with anybody in the background. You know, to be honest, the background players, the later round players they've picked recently have been more you know, organizational types and those type of players. You know, maybe, you know, Alex Hassan at the 20, but he wasn't a big bonus guy. So I think maybe you might see them do something like that, because in 2007, you know, they didn't have a first round pick, so they knew that they weren't paying that big money, and they were able to go grab Britton. So I think maybe, you know, maybe that's something that we might see, that they might have a two or three of those guys that they try to sign to lure him out of college, who maybe slipped, and people thought, you know, I'm not going to take this guy because he's going to go to college, and the Red Sox grab him in the 25th round and give him $600,000, $700,000, $800,000.
Isn't that change more based on what other teams are doing too, though? I mean, these guys, nobody's drafting bonus players that late anymore. I think that's more what it is to me. And I just wonder, you know, piggybacking on the comments we've said, it remains to be seen if other teams are going to change what they do, and that then changes what the Red Sox do in their strategy. I don't know. What do you think, Ian?
I said that's a very good point. I mean, if you look at just the last 3 years, you're seeing teams like the Pirates and the Royals do specifically what the Red Sox have been doing, and that's just throw money. I mean, it's now with like top picks in the top first five rounds, but they're now spending millions of dollars on their non-first round picks just to acquire talent. And these are the, you know, the Royals and the Pirates we're talking about. So
yeah, it seems like the reach picks used to be in the 20s, the guys that you didn't think you'd be able to sign that you're going to throw a ton of money at, and then it's in the last probably two seasons, those have gone in like the fifth to ninth round now, but there have been a few players that sneak through down to the lower rounds that that are kind of the reach picks, and the Red Sox just haven't been able to sign those, like the Adam Duke from last year. There's a couple others that are slipping my mind, but there were a couple other guys that were like $500,000 to $700,000 bonus type of guys that the Sox just decided not to go. And Eric Jaffe was the other one. They did slip, but they were the guys that were like, we might not sign unless their numbers come down. So I do want to talk about some general players. We've been kind of trying to keep track of players that have been linked to the Sox, either by players that have come in for workouts or players that we've heard firsthand have the Red Sox have scouted more than a few times. And I got a list of 10 guys that I just want to reel off quick that the Red Sox seem to be really hot on that could go anywhere in the top 100 picks, and that's Matt Barnes, a righty out of UConn, Josh Bell, an outfielder, a high school outfielder out of Texas, Mikey Matuk, an outfielder out of LSU, Tyler Beede, who's a local product, righty out of Lawrence Academy, who we had a Q&A with this past week, something you should check out if you haven't had an opportunity to read yet, by John Gray, a really good piece, Kyle Crick, a righty out of Sherman High School in Texas, Tyler Marlett, a catcher out of Florida, Charlie Tilson, an outfielder out of Illinois, Johnny Eierman, a shortstop out of Missouri, and Joe Ross, a righty out of Bishop O'Dowd High School in California. One more is Amir Garrett, a lefty out of Findlay Prep in Nevada. So I want to just talk about a couple of these guys and what we know about them, starting off with Matt Barnes. I guess we can say he's a local guy if he's from UConn. Ian, what do you know about Barnes?
Barnes is basically been a top 20 lock since last summer on the Cape. He's not exactly your prototypical college righty. He's got a lot more power. He sits 92 to 94. He's got a great breaking ball. He'll throw a two-seam fastball. He had a great season. There's really very little downside there. I think if you're looking at a pitcher who can get to the big leagues fast, he's probably a good guy to pluck with 19. He could be, you know, he could be challenging for some type of spot on the roster within 2 to 3 years.
What do you think the chances are that he falls to 19?
It's right now. It's not looking good. There are a couple teams ahead of us who I think are eyeing him, and just by the mere fact that he's a power arm that's also has a decent amount of polish, those guys usually don't last long. I wouldn't be surprised if he was a top 10 pick.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, the next guy I want to talk about is Josh Bell, who's a high school outfielder out of Texas. A lot of power from both sides of the plate. Strong arm, a good athlete. The issue that's come up recently is I think he has a strong commitment. Is it to Texas, Ian?
Yeah, Texas.
To Texas, and he's now telling teams not to draft him because he's going to Texas, no matter what. And sometimes in the past we've seen that as a smokescreen to try to fall to a team that's going to pay more money. Sometimes in the past that's been something that somebody really legitimately wants to go to school and doesn't want people to draft him. So it's hard to say what to make of that from here. But he's supposed to be a top 15 pick. But I suppose that situation could cause him to fall to the Red Sox in 19. And do they take that chance on him? I don't know. What do you guys think?
Like you said, I mean, it's hard to earnestly gauge how much he means by this. But because we really aren't in a position to judge, like, we don't know what the normal process is that they go through when they say they seriously don't want to be drafted, or when they're just kind of doing it for show. So we don't. I mean, he went to the head of the Major League Scouting Bureau and basically said, "Don't draft me." I mean, that sounds like it's pretty serious. Mm-hmm. But I don't know.
It's not quite the same as just going to the guy who you've been talking to for a few weeks and saying, "You know what? We've been talking."
Right.
You know, and that I don't know. I mean, I don't really know what to make of either way, to be honest with you. But
I guess the one thing is that you know, the word was that Theo was down in Texas at one of his high school games last weekend.
Right.
Wouldn't Theo have the intel prior to going, taking a flight to Texas?
Right. Why would he waste his time?
Right. I mean, this is not, he's not even, I don't even think the scouting director, if they didn't think that he would had some chance of signing, mm-hmm. let alone the GM.
And he's a Texas guy? He's out of Texas, so that's Jim Robinson's territory, mostly. That's one of the better amateur scouts in the Red Sox organization. He typically signed guys like Britton, Middlebrooks. He usually has his pulse on what's going on. He's very, very highly talked of by people who work with him.
So maybe it is just a smokescreen. That'd be very interesting for somebody to fall, for him to fall to 19. Reminds me a little bit of a player last year. I think it was Austin Wilson, was an outfielder out of California. That it was kind of my binky, was my favorite player in the whole draft. That I wanted the Red Sox to go after. He told them that he told teams that he wasn't going to sign. He was going to college. He slipped all the way to the 19th or 20th round or something. The Cardinals took him. They didn't sign him. And he went to Stanford this year as a freshman. He played pretty well. I think he hit like 310 with a decent amount of power and some stolen bases, and might be will probably be a decent prospect again in a few years when he's eligible. But that could be the same situation, or it could just be a smokescreen. So that's an interesting something interesting to watch there. The next player we want to look at is Mikey Matuk. And he's a outfielder out of LSU. Ian, what do you know about him?
Very athletic college outfielder. Good power, good speed, all around. You know, all around good player. Kind of reminds me of Austin Kearns type player. Mm-hmm. Someone who's not going to be a star, but can be a serviceable, or even better than serviceable, a good outfielder. Again, it's right now. It's looking like he won't even make it to us. Teams like the Mets and teams who typically draft college players are keying on him, because he's one of the top three college outfielders available.
Yeah. Yeah.
So again, it's you know, it's touch and go. We'll see. But yeah, he's definitely, if we take him, I'd be happy, because I've liked him as a prospect since the beginning of the season.
Yep. The next player we're talking about is Tyler Beede. That's the local product we were talking about, a righty out of Lawrence Academy. Real good frame, 6'4", 200. Gets his fastball up to 95 miles an hour. Also has a pretty decent changeup for his age, and is working on a curveball that could be plus. And is also working on a slider. So he's a potential potential starter over the long term. Has a strong commitment to Vanderbilt, and is supposedly looking for big numbers. But I've seen quite a few people projecting him to go to the Red Sox in with one of their supplemental picks, and that wouldn't surprise me whatsoever. I think that's a pretty decent projection. He's the type of player the Red Sox like. Every so often they go in their own backyard, and they are one of the few teams that will they're one of the teams that will spend the money on a player like that with that amount of projection. So anybody else want to put any input on Bede based on what we've heard from the scouting reports or based on what we've read from John Gray's column?
I mean, it makes sense for the Red Sox to go after a local high school kid. I mean, who's the last high schooler in this area that's gone that high? I mean, was it Westmoreland?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, yep. You know, I mean, it kind of makes an awful lot of sense. I mean, you could also see a kid giving teams an inflated number to scare them off and then having him fall to the Red Sox at 40, say, you know, or maybe 36, depending on who else is out there. But that's one of those things that just seems to make sense and for good reason.
Mm-hmm. Have they been heavily linked to him?
He was in for a workout, and he said that the team has come out and seen him at least more than a few times. So
I've seen at least one mock with him getting picked by the Sox.
They didn't mention any names. Any names who have seen him? Just.
I don't remember.
Theo saw him, didn't he? Didn't Theo go and see him? I thought that came out earlier in the season.
Yeah.
Maybe it wasn't Theo.
Was it him or Leatherzich? Or however you say his name, the kid from Lowell.
UMass Lowell.
Maybe it was him.
Yeah, Jack Leatherzich is another local product out of UMass Lowell that we had a Q&A with last week. That's somebody that could go in the supplemental or second round. So that'll be interesting. That's another story to watch. Would be really a good storyline if he's able to get selected by the Sox and they could sign him up this season, signing season. The last linked player that I want to talk about, Ian wanted to just drop a note on this, a player named Amir Garrett, a lefty out of Findlay Prep in Nevada. What do you know about him?
He's I know people, when they describe two-sport athletes, they always call the kid a star in his other sport. Yeah. He's like a legitimate star in basketball. He's going to St. John's. I mean, he's a top 100 player in the country by, you know, rivals.com, all that stuff. And he goes to Findlay Prep, which is the premier powerhouse on the West Coast in terms of basketball right now. So he's from L.A. He's 6'5". He's a lefty. I guess he worked out for the Red Sox. He was throwing 92 and 94. I think, you know, I would bet that he probably isn't much more than that now. Mm-hmm. But there's a ton of projectability there. There's a ton of athleticism. And there's probably a ton of money that's involved in buying him out. But he could be someone that could be in that third to five round range.
Yeah. Okay. In terms of the players that are linked, Ian made his projection last year that he made the guarantee that Sean Coyle was going to go to the Red Sox in one of the later rounds. Do you have any projections like that this year as somebody that the Red Sox might be looking at in like that fourth, fifth round that might just fall to them?
One guy is, I don't know if it's a fourth, this might be like a fifth to tenth, but he's a kid named CJ Owens.
Yeah.
I think he's a lefty out of California high school.
Yeah. Right. A righty out of, St. Mary's High School in California. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I've heard a few things about him too. That's a pretty decent guess. My other projection is as a second or third rounder is Charlie Tilson, an outfielder out of New Trier High School in Illinois. I think he's somebody that the Red Sox might target in the third round. Just thrown out there as a possibility. So we don't have a ton of time. We want to cover a few more points on the draft. Before we move on to the actual prospects in the system, I want to give you guys a list of players I've seen projected to possibly fall to the Red Sox. There's a few of them, but I'll try to go through them quickly. Taylor Greery is a righty out of Spring Valley High School in South Carolina. Probably has the most helium in the draft right now, and I doubt that he falls to the Red Sox. He's projecting as a top 10 pick now. George Springer, an outfielder out of UConn, probably won't fall to the Red Sox, but who knows? Similarly, Jed Bradley, a lefty out of Georgia Tech. Ian, is Jed Bradley, is he the one that's asking for $6 million, or is that one of the other Bradleys?
No, that's Archie Bradley from Oklahoma. He's a high school pitcher.
Okay, I get confused because there's three Bradleys that are supposed to go in the first 25 picks this year, so there's going to be a little confusion there.
But Chad Bradley, he's a college pitcher, and he's great.
Yep. Then we got Daniel Norris, a lefty out of Science Hill High School in Tennessee. Most of the mock drafts I've seen lately have the Red Sox taking Blake Swihart, a catcher out of Cleveland High School in New Mexico. Do you know much about him, Ian?
He's a switch hitting catcher. He's very athletic, a little small. I think he's in the 6 foot, 175 pound area. But he's going to stay at the position. He's got good power and good athleticism.
Mm-hmm. A couple other guys I've seen projected to go there are Jose Fernandez, a righty out of Florida; Austin Hedges, a catcher out of California; Andrew Susak, a catcher out of Oregon State, who's a lot of people are projecting the Red Sox to go after as well. I've seen a couple of mock drafts where some of the professional services have the Sox taking Swihart and Susak, both catchers. That'd be kind of interesting and odd. One other interesting name I want to point out is Matt Perk, a lefty out of Texas Tech, back about probably
Texas Christian,
TCU.
TCU, I'm sorry. He back about last August or so, I talked to a professional agent and a professional scout who had him as 1-1, number one overall pick for this upcoming draft, over Anthony Rendon, who was pretty much universally thought to be 1-1 going for quite a while, and still is regarded one of the more likely first picks this year, or the best player to come out of this draft, 1, 2, or 3. But Perk his stock has fallen quite a bit this year. He's looking like a late first rounder, or maybe even a supplemental or second rounder. His velocity has dropped. Ian, do you have any explanation as what's going on there?
I think he had injuries early in the year. Mm-hmm. It just hasn't come back yet, and a lot of people were concerned to begin with his injury risk and kind of his arm slot and the way he throws. So this kind of confirms fears, which makes it worse than something that people could say, oh, that's a one-time injury that they'll just brush aside.
Does it remind you at all of what happened with Renato last year?
It does, to the extent that I think that's what happened. The path that Renato took, I think, is the path that he's going to take. Mm-hmm. I think he'll probably be drafted sometime in that supplemental or second round, and he'll go to the Cape League or maybe some other league, and he will try to work his way back to the bonus he thinks he's deserved. The other interesting aspect is that he was the Rangers' first-round pick in 2009, and he turned down, I think, $5 million.
$5 or $6 million,
to the college.
But is he more Joba Chamberlain or Anthony Renato? Because that's the type of kid I could also see the Red Sox just taking off their board if he's a past injury. As we've heard that Chamberlain was a guy that the Red Sox didn't even have on their board.
Right.
I mean, is he a guy that they would just take all the way off their board because of the injury risk?
I don't think so. I don't think it's that dire. I think it depends on the medicals they have. I'm sure they have. I'm sure every team has been digging deep on those. But I don't really know why they took Chaba off the board. That was kind of a mystery at the time. So we'll see. It'll be interesting. That's one of the storylines that will be interesting to watch.
Yep. The last few guys that I've seen projected to go to the Sox in some of these, at maybe late day one, early day two, Andrew Chafin, a lefty out of Kent State, Josh Oshik, a lefty out of Oregon State, Anthony Mio, a righty out of Coastal Carolina, Derek Fisher, an outfielder out of Pennsylvania High School, and Jason Esposito, a third baseman from Vanderbilt. And then the last thing I just want to cover before we finish up the draft preview is just a list of players that might slip due to signability. Whether these players will slip to the Red Sox at 19 is still up in the air. The top few probably won't. But the list of players we have right now is the most likely to be signability risks. Bubba Starling, who's one of the top prospects in the draft, he's not slipping to 19. Archie Bradley, who's a quarterback commit to Oklahoma. He's projected as a top 10. I think he's the one that wants $6 million, but he still probably won't make it past the top 10 or 12. Josh Bell, who we've talked about. Alex Meyer, who's a previously passed on a $2 million offer from the Red Sox and is a Boris advisee. He's somebody that might slip to 19, but whether the Red Sox are still interested or not is a question mark. Ian, I seem to recall that you had some strong feelings about whether we go that way or not.
Towards Meyer?
Yeah.
I just don't think that... I think in hindsight, it was probably a blessing that he didn't sign. Mm-hmm. Not that he isn't a solid prospect, but I just don't think he's just not there for me. Not worth that money.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's just my opinion.
Okay. And then
if I could throw, yeah. Oh, sorry, go for it, Mike.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead, Hadfield.
Well, I was going to say in the research I've done in the past 25 minutes. another name I've seen out there is Austin Hedges, a high school catcher. Yep. And the thing that I'm wondering is between Hedges, Susak, and Blake Swihart, those are three guys that I've actually seen even before the past 25 minutes linked with the Sox a lot. I mean, is the catcher thing just conveniently born out of the fact that the Red Sox don't seem to have the catcher of the future in the system and, quote-unquote, need one? I mean, is it just out of convenience, or do we think that there's actually a chance they're going to take a catcher? Because I think I could see that being a question a lot of people have, given the fact that especially now that a lot of the catcher prospects are maybe not turning into pumpkins, so to speak, but showing that they may be more of MLB backup types.
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, it's a convenient thing for these purported draft experts to say, okay, the Red Sox don't have an elite catcher in this system, and they don't have an elite catcher at the top level, so might as well throw a catcher in these mock drafts. But at the same time, there's a little bit of reasoning behind that, and there are some catchers that are projected to be in the 19 to 26 range that could be good fits for the Red Sox. So I think it is a little bit of both. I think you bring up a good point, but I think maybe there is some chance that these catchers could fall to the Red Sox, and they are also, those were a couple other players that I was going to list as possible signability concerns. Hedges has a strong commitment to UCLA. Susak is a draft eligible sophomore, which always makes people tough to sign.
To answer your question, I think that's one of the reasons people link them to the Red Sox. They'll just link whatever tough sign.
Yeah.
To the Red Sox.
Yeah. The other tough signs we have is Dylan Howard. He has a strong commitment to Arkansas. Mm-hmm. Matt Perk might be a tough sign because he's a sophomore eligible. He did not have a great season, but again, he turned down $6 million in 2009. Tyler Beede, we already discussed. Fisher, somebody we already discussed a little bit. He has a strong commitment to UVA, so Hatfield, you might be seeing him next year if he doesn't sign.
Nice.
Charlie Tilson is a guy that that was one of my projections that the Red Sox pick later on, but he's supposedly has a strong commitment to Illinois and really wants to go back to school. And Swihart was the other one that basically has a strong Texas commitment. So that's the list of guys that could slip to 19, 26, or even further because of signability that the Red Sox might scoop up and just pay them the money. We'll cover it more in the upcoming draft preview. We'll have in a lot more detail, but that's basically where we're coming from for today in our limited amount of time. Is there anything else you guys wanted to just touch on? You want to make a prediction on who you think that the Sox might pick with 19 right now, and just anybody want to throw something out there? Ian, how about you?
I'll say Jed Bradley.
Okay.
All right. I'll throw a pick out there. I feel like the Red Sox are going to take a high school kid at that spot. What the heck? And I'll go with Jose Fernandez, the righty pitcher, high school pitcher.
All right. Melon, how about you?
I think they're going to go with the local college product for out of UConn, Matt Barnes. He fits the profile, hard throwing right hander. He's polished. Mm-hmm. You know, with one of those first three picks they have, they got to hopefully take a guy who can track quickly up through the minors. And I think that's the guy that they'll look at. You know, I like his profile.
I'm going kind of similar to you. I'm going local on both. I'm gonna project that George Springer falls to 19, the outfielder out of UConn, and they take him, and that at 26, or possibly the supplemental round pick, they go with Tyler Beede and get a couple of local guys, which would be real, real nice.
Yeah, I can see them getting Beede in the supplemental round.
Right.
Definitely.
And then Swihart is probably my fallback option. So that's our draft preview. Thanks for listening. We're moving on to the real prospects now. And we're going to talk about Hatfield and Mellon's wonderful trip down south. All right, guys, just give us a little background. When did you go down there? Who did you see? Who did you meet? Who did you talk to? What players did you like? Mellon, start it up.
All right. I got down there on Friday, got into Greenville in the afternoon. I spent 3 days in Greenville at Floor Field, and I have to say that's the best baseball take I've been to. I really enjoyed that ballpark and the atmosphere. If you're planning a trip, you know, a little minor league trip, or you're looking at visiting a couple of the Red Sox affiliates, you know, definitely check out Greenville. The people there, real accommodating. You know, they rolled out the red carpet. It seemed like there, you know, Eric Jarenko, who's the media director there, was fantastic, and everybody there was really accommodating and helpful. You can follow Eric on Twitter. He's at Eric S. Jarenko, J-A-R-I-N-K-O. He does an excellent job with the Twitter feed and keeping – it's almost like he's almost instantaneous with the game updates during the game for Greenville. You guys should check him out. So in Greenville, I saw Miguel Celestino pitch on Friday. Manny Rivera pitched on Saturday, and Kyle Stroup pitched on Sunday. Majority of the pitching position players played, with the exception of Sean Coyle, as he was scratched from the lineup real late on Friday, and it ended up that he had that shoulder and went on the disabled list. I then made my way to Salem, and Salem, it's a really, really scenic view at that ballpark. You got these mountains in the background, and you know, Hatfield, he notices it too. You know, these high walls out in the outfield, about 25-foot walls all the way around. You can tell that's kind of why maybe those guys have a little bit tough time homering at home. The walls are much higher than your average minor league ballpark. It's just a real nice take there too. Low key, you know, it was raining. The weather wasn't great. The crowds were small. But Evan Lepler, the broadcaster extraordinaire, he sings "Take Me Out to the Ball Game" every seventh inning. He does a really good job with everything, and
he sings it too. Like he doesn't go halfway on it. He actually hits the notes.
He sings it. Yeah, impressive. Very impressive. And they had it. You know, that was very good take there too.
You guys met the Greenville broadcaster as well, right?
Yes, I met it. I was on the air with Ed Jensen on Sunday. I did the whole broadcast with him, just talking big prospects and Greenville baseball. And Ed, real knowledgeable guy. You know, you guys should, if you're listening to the games, you know, definitely tune into Ed. He's got a good take on what's going on in the field, and he's really tied into the Greenville team. You know, so players wise out of Greenville, I liked what I – number one, I wrote him up, so that would be the first guy was Brandon Jacobs. I liked what I saw out of Jacobs basically because, you know, he was real rough and raw in my opinion when he was with Lowell last season. And, you know, his body was more of a football body, and he was kind of a little bit less than fluid with his swing mechanics. He was rough out in the outfield, and he's starting to look more and more like a baseball player, and I think he's starting to lean down in the upper body, and first and foremost that's helping out his throwing arm, which I would have termed slightly below average last year. He's getting to the point where he could end up with a slightly above average arm. I know a lot of times when guys drop the weight in their shoulders and chest, that's a hindrance to them being able to throw his release looked a lot quicker. He still has a very tough time judging balls out in the outfield. He's a little bit slow getting started. He's never going to play center field. He's a straight left fielder, which kind of hurts his projection a little bit, because a lot of times you start with the center fielders and then you can project them over to right field or left field at the major league level if it doesn't work out defensively for them, or their offense blossoms or whatever. So with Jacobs, he's definitely going to be a left fielder, but he just looked like he was emerging into a baseball player. Now it's going to be, you know, slow development. He's 20 years old, but he just seemed to look like like he was taking those steps towards getting an idea of what was going on at the plate and having a plan. And he was hitting the ball. He hits the ball. You know, he hits the ball hard. And he's got a slight uppercut, which kind of hinders him attacking inside pitches. That's going to be something to watch going up the ladder when pitchers can consistently throw, you know, low to mid 90s on the inside corner. You know, you would think, I know it's professional baseball, but in the lower levels, the guys who throw hard are actually a little bit fewer and further between. You know, as you go up levels, the slower guys tend to get weeded out. So there's more hard throwers in Double A and Triple A, but down in A ball, and Ian knows this in the New York Penn League, it's more rare that you see a kid who sits in the, you know, from 92 to up to 95. That's just rare. So Jacobs looked pretty good. I thought that Celestino, you know, they had that brawl on the second pitch. There, I guess I should talk about that with Slade Heathcock. Celestino hit Slade Heathcock, the Yankees prospect, with the second pitch of the game, and all hell broke loose pretty much afterwards. And there was a solid 3-minute brawl with a lot of shots thrown and just guys getting tackled. And it was enjoyable to watch, but it kind of also broke up the rhythm of the game. And then Celestino had to come back out and pitch after he did throw a punch and got suspended for 3 games, so he did get his money's worth on that one. And Celestino. He was the player to be named later in the Bill Hall Casey Kochman trade. He's got a live arm. He can get it. He sits 92, 93. Can get it up to 95 consistently. He's one of the hard throwers. Very much more high. Oh, much more max effort and high effort in his delivery, which kind of leads me to believe that he could profile as a reliever down the line. He gets everything into getting his velocity, which right, he throws 95. That's not a bad thing, but you know the fact it's not easy. So to me, he looked more like a potential future reliever. I liked his arm. His slider is coming along. His changeup probably grades as his best pitch. I'd call that average to better. You know, he gets good arm speed with that. His slider's slightly below average, and his fastball plus velocity, but below average command. So you could grade that around average too. So right now, maybe slightly below average, probably. And Celestino was, you know, he battled through the outing. It's tough, you know. It's only one view. It's just what I saw in that one game. I'll see him more, you know, hopefully next season down in Salem and beyond. Outside of those two, Juan Rodriguez, big arm coming out of the bullpen. You know, it's 94 to 96. It's straight though. Wrinkle slider. You know, he has a big arm. He's definitely on my radar. And
how does he compare to like a Roman Mendez from last year?
He's much more max effort than Roman Mendez. Mendez more over the top thrower. Rodriguez comes down from a almost high three quarter, in between a high and mid three quarters. Slings the ball a touch. He gets good arm extension. He's fluid. It doesn't look like he's getting everything. Again, he's getting everything he can in behind the pitch. There's no drag. There's nothing that's – it's not fluid, though. I mean,
But in terms of, like, projection, you think that Mendez projects a lot better than Rodriguez, or are they similar, or what do you think?
I think Mendez projects better – Mendez projected better to me. Mendez is a late-inning guy and a potential closer. Rodriguez more as a 6-7 type guy. Okay. If he can develop more of a slider than what he throws now is just basically like a spinner. Like it kind of looks just like a bat. It looks like a below average slider, but because there's a little bit of break and he's throwing 95, guys swing. But I think now you've seen him gotten kind of touched up the last couple of innings. I think now guys are just saying, don't swing at anything that has any type of break on him. Just sit on his fastball.
Right. And he's got beat up the last couple of times he's been
out
there.
Yeah, and the report out of last night's outing was that he was just pumping fastballs right over the middle of the plate, and they were just sitting all over it. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Brent's look. Go ahead.
No, I was going to add. You read my mind. I was going to ask about Brent's because you were down there for the tail end of his hit streak.
Yeah, Brent's was a good story because you know the crowd was into him, the staff was into him. He had some some dramatics in the Friday night game. His hit streak was on the line. He got down 0-2 in his last at bat, and the pitcher threw him a really what I would call a bad fastball right over the middle of the plate, 0-2, and he lined it for a nice home run over that mini monster they have there, almost off the brick building they have across the street to extend his hit streak. It was nice dramatics, it was nice theatrics, but the pitch was, I mean, if that was a bad 0-2 pitch, and if you don't hit a home run, you know, if you don't hit that pitch for a home run, you're not going to hit a home run. It just you know, that was the type of things that Brents was running into, guys just making a ton of mistakes. He sat out the next game because Brents is not – he does not prefer to DH, and they wanted to give him a day off, so he said, just sit me out. I don't really want to sit there and DH. So he sat out on Saturday, and he came back on Sunday, and again, he went down to his last at-bat. They needed five guys to extend the inning for him. He came up, first pitch, fastball, a little bit middle in, and he just crushed it over their 420-foot marker. That they have a mini triangle. He crushed it over the 420-foot marker into some trees that I think it had to go about 435 by my estimate. You're going over the wall. It was deep. It was like one of those. It kind of almost reminded me of Mike Piazza when he would hit one of those bombs to just right center of center field, like one of those swings where it's a little bit inside, but he just kind of like insides it. Right, hits right onto the baseball and just crushes it. Mm-hmm. You know, it was absolutely launched, and that kind of, you know, those were the only two hits that he got. So when I was there, two home runs, and they were very dramatic. But it was apparent that he was not being challenged, and there was really no need to keep him there just pounding mistakes. And he's gotta tighten up the approach. There were a couple times when he chased and hitters count some balls that were elevated that he couldn't get his hands above, or reached out and tried to yank a couple balls that he grounded out on. So I think, you know, that's something to continue, you know, watching with him. But he was in enough of a groove that it's good for him. The baseball probably looked real big, and he was just ripping it. So I think they did a good job building him back up after, you know, struggling initially after signing.
Hatfield, what do you want to add to what you saw during the trip?
Well, I was only in Salem, of course, but a couple things that were interesting while I was down there. That was the beginning of the Reynaldo Rodriguez outfield experiment. When Mellon and I were there, we caught our last game there was his first game in left field for Salem. And he had one pretty bad error on a kind of grounder to the outfield that he let under his glove. So he's still a work in progress out there. But, I mean, he definitely kind of stood out as a hitter on that team. I don't know. I think you agreed with me on that one, Mellon. But, you know, he just kind of, he went up there looking like a hitter as opposed to some of these guys who are still kind of feeling their way through. One thing that was really noticeable was that Peter Hissey has completely changed his mechanics at the plate. He's hitting out of a crouch now, as opposed to he was a lot more straight up in the past couple of seasons. And it seems like he's getting a little bit more on the ball when he hits it now, which is good because he's still pretty skinny looking. I can't see him filling out too much, to be honest with you. That frame, I don't know. Maybe you disagree with me or maybe you agree, Chris. But, you know, he's got to try. I think he's going to have to try and find other ways to get more behind the ball when he hits it, and I think that was an interesting way to go about that. Other good things I saw, I mean, Colburn Vitek is still really rough at third base, but he's at least putting the work in. I mean, I know at least one occasion during BP, I saw him getting some extra ground balls on the side. And, you know, I think that's something we kind of take for granted. We kind of assume players who might be struggling at a position or something do automatically do that, but there are certainly other players whose work ethics that I was not particularly impressed with while I was down there. You see guys kind of, you know, going halfway on the stretching and things like that, you know, acting like they're still coasting off of large bonuses. I might as well just go there. I mean, you can tell why Michael Almanzar has been terrible. I mean, he does the effort's just not there. It's kind of sickening to see at this point, honestly. You'd think after struggling for two seasons, he'd, you know, kind of get it, but apparently he hasn't.
Did you catch a Drake Britton start?
I did. I was going to save that one for Mellon because he was the one who had the gun on him that game. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, Britton had a good start while we were down there. I mean, the thing that I heard kind of scuttlebutt with some of the guys I was talking to was that, I mean, his thing is that he's just kind of in his head right now. You know, he kind of wasn't locating at the start of the year, and now he's kind of, you know, that's kind of gotten to him a little bit. So a little bit of adversity isn't a bad thing for a guy coming through. And I think it's almost, I think it's a good thing that he's struggling a little bit right now at this level rather than, you know, being one level away from the majors. You know, hopefully he can work his control issues out. I mean, he might be a candidate to go for that 2-week vacation coming up kind of soon here. You know, go ahead. Chris is.
Yeah, Mellon, what do you want to add about Britton? We want to wrap up the Southern trip in the next two or three minutes, and then we're just going to talk about the last few games in Pawtucket and wrap up for the day. So okay. Just hit us up with what your thoughts are on Britton is.
No, I know people have seen his line, and maybe they get a little bit down. You know, his walks, he's walked a ton of people, but the stuff's there. You know, I was more than impressed with the level of his stuff, and I'm a tools and a stuff guy. You know, bat speed jumps out at me. You know, a guy doesn't necessarily have to throw 95 for it to jump out at me, but the crispness of the stuff and just that explosiveness on his fastball. And when I talked about Celestino not generating easy velocity and kind of being more max effort, Britton comes out of his delivery just so smooth and fluid, and the ball explodes out of his hand. It's not a max delivery. He's slower with his pace. You know, he's 6'2" right now, probably 210 pounds. You know, some of the chatter around is that he's like a smaller John Lester, and you can tell he definitely modeled his mechanics after Lester. And like Lester does, and Lester still does in the big leagues, Britton tends to release his fastball early, and that's where he's really struggling. He pitches with an arch back, so he bends and drops his shoulder back a little bit too much, and he loses his fastball command, and he can't repeat his arm slot consistently, and that's really what's going on. That's one of the roots. That's the main root of his struggles right now, is that he's just finding his release point, and he's becoming more, you know, consistent, comfortable in his skin, and it's going to take him some time to just be comfortable with constantly repeating his fastball over and over again. Because when he does get that optimal point and throw it, it's explosive, and it finishes very late and has a lot of hop to it at the end, and batters just don't have much of a chance of making contact on it, even when they're gearing up for it. He still throws a really good curveball. He showed a lot of that curveball with depth and teeth tight rotation. You know, 76 to 79 miles an hour, that comes from about, you know, the eye level to the knee level. It's very, very sharp. And I think that, as you know, last year with Stolme Pimentel, he wasn't, you know, you see him getting beat up in Double A this year, and last year in High A, he didn't struggle, you know, quite as much as Britton. And I think that's because Pimentel can throw a changeup, and that's his best pitch. And Britton doesn't have much of a changeup. He threw 79 pitches in that outing. He threw one changeup, and he must have thrown, you know, 60 fastballs, maybe 63 fastballs. So he can't. You know, revert to a changeup like Pimentel could when he doesn't have his fastball. He can't, like Buchholz, just constantly pitch off his off-speed stuff in the minor leagues and just make batters kind of look foolish. And then you realize when he gets up to the major leagues or Double A to the major leagues that he doesn't have any fastball command. I mean, this is the point in time where Britton's lack of fastball command, because he can't repeat his release point consistently, is being exposed. Which I think that's a good thing, so that it doesn't allow him to kind of cheat his way up the ladder and get to that leveling point later on in his career, like we've seen with some other people. And I think this will make him a better prospect. It's going to make him a better pitcher. But I talk with other scouts who from other organizations who see him, and they think it's just, you know, it's going to take time. You know, sometimes it just takes time for these kids to find that consistent arm slot, and it's not a matter of his stuff, and you know, it's more mechanical than anything else right now.
Okay, that's a pretty good thorough review. Like I said, we want to talk. Both of Mel and I have been to Pawtucket over the last 2 days, so we just wanted to talk about real quickly, just in a minute or so, what you saw out of Andrew Miller on Saturday, I believe it was Saturday or Sunday, and anything else that stuck out at you when you were in Pawtucket.
Sure. As I wrote up with Andrew Miller, he was very fastball dominant in that outing. I think it was 55 fastballs out of 80 pitches, 13 sliders, 12 changeups, if I remember off the top of my head. I know that Miller's been a very fastball-dependent pitcher. He was mostly sitting 92 to 93, dipped down a little bit in the later outing, but was able to touch up to 94 in his seventh inning of work. Hit 95 twice in the first inning. His fastball is live. It's a little bit on the straight side. Unlike Britton and Lester, who tend to release the ball behind them early, Miller looks like he releases the – he'll hold on to the ball too long. And I don't know if they have him or he's adjusted himself, but he's down around a mid three quarters to almost like a high sidearm, similar to where Randy Johnson threw, if you remember at his level, maybe a little bit higher than Randy Johnson. So when Miller struggles, it's because he's way out in front releasing the ball, and he throws it low. Majority of his balls miss low. He low and inside. He didn't have the ball up in the zone all too much. And what the good for him was that he was throwing his fastball more for strikes. I didn't think his secondary offerings were all that sharp. His slider is his curveball velocity with slider break. I think I'd like to see that. I don't know if he can do something to, you know, at 25 now to tighten that up more into a tight slider. And his changeup, he tried to throw it, but his changeup, he actually threw from more of a higher arm slot. He dipped his back shoulder back and almost came over the top. So you could really pick it up. And I think if I'm picking it up up in the stands, and the hitters down there are definitely picking that up. And I think one guy out of 12 of them, he got one or two swings out of 12 changeups. So the 10 of them were takes. So that, you know, and I don't remember how many of them were called strikes on the takes, but not many. So with Miller, I think, you know, it's, I know I did see that he has that out clause on the 15th of June. If I were him, I would kind of look to maybe, you know, waive that and stick down there, because
push it out for another month or two, or a month or something.
Yeah, I think he's getting comfortable in his skin and he's starting to make progress, but I don't know. I think that big league hitters would be able to sit all over his fastball, because he has to throw it in the zone for a strike.
But I noticed that you said that he could be a potential bullpen contributor maybe when September rolls around.
Yeah, I would think, you know, I would give him 6-7 more weeks. I know they can probably afford to be patient. That's just with me, because, you know, as Ian, I know Ian's always been, Ian referred him as one of the most terrible pitchers in the last couple of years or something, but he's bad. I mean, when he goes, even at the minor league level, but his strikeouts to walks and he gets hit a ton when he's at the major league level. And I don't know what could have happened in 2 months now of a season that's going to change that. You know, I don't know if there's a magic cure in 6 to 8 weeks. I know people like the numbers and, you know, he's got a live arm, but I still saw some stuff there that I think he needs to polish off.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, the walks are indicative of that in of itself. All right, I'm going to move on to my day in Pawtucket yesterday, just so we can wrap up in about 2 minutes, so we can even this off at an even hour. Two things I noticed yesterday in Pawtucket. I saw DuBront's first start in 3 weeks. He pitched pretty well, was on a short lease, only threw 3 1/3 innings. Just gave up a hit and two walks, struck out 5. Looked pretty good. I really think he's advanced past AAA competition. One thing I noticed is his velocity was a little bit down yesterday. He was throwing 89 to 91 mostly, when I'm used to seeing him 91 to 93. That just could be a product of him not having pitched in 3 weeks, and that could be something that could come back quickly. But the other thing I noticed about DuBron is something that I talked to Mellon about, that he noticed when he was there this weekend as well, is he's not looking like he's in that good a shape. He's listed at 6'2", 165, and if I had to guess, he's probably more like 6'2", 225. He's got a little bit of a gut, almost like I remember a couple of years ago, Josh Beckett reported a spring training with a little bit of a gut, and kind of received some negative attention for that. And that's a little bit what DuBront looks like now. I don't know if it's because I don't remember seeing him in spring training, noticing him in spring training like that, or if he's just been forced to not work out because of whatever injury he's had for the last 3 weeks. But he seems like he could lose a good 10 pounds and tighten up get his body back into shape sooner rather than later, especially if he wants to become that fifth starter that the Red Sox might need some point in the season.
Didn't something come out in spring training about how the Sox weren't happy about the shape he came into the season in?
That very well could be the case. That doesn't...
I feel like I remember that happening.
That yeah, sounds that vaguely familiar.
That definitely happened.
Yeah, he's just... He looked a little bit... I mean, he didn't look... For a kid that's 23, he doesn't look like he is in the shape of a 23-year-old. He looks like he's in the shape of a guy that has let himself go a little bit and had a few too many donuts or something. Not like he's fat, but he's bigger than he should be for a 23-year-old starting pitcher. And I think that something can be remedied soon. And I'm sure that the Red Sox front office are going to get on top of that and are probably on top of it right now and will not let it happen next spring. So that's something to watch. My last point before we wrap up is just I did see an amazing play by Jose Iglesias that I just wanted to point out. He ranged a grounder between third base and the shortstop that the third baseman couldn't get to. He was probably five steps beyond where the third baseman ended up, nabbed it through diving away while he was diving away, threw under his opposite arm to second base, like almost like a no look pass, and nailed the runner at second base for a fielder's choice. It was amazing, and he actually afterwards must have flipped around and hurt himself because he was on the ground for a good 3 or 4 minutes, and the trainers had to come out and check on him. But he ended up staying in the game. But just another one of those wow moments that you see out of the kid that I think that we're going to see for years to come. I know I've been kind of pessimistic about his bat, but the defense is just – it's awesome. It's going to be something to watch in the future.
Do you think that he'll be the greatest shortstop of all time or just the best fielder of all time in Major League Baseball?
You know what? He could be one of the better fielders of all time. I mean, that's I know you're giving a little bit of hyperbole, but he is an outstanding fielder, and it's going to be something that's really fun to watch. And maybe he'll be the best shortstop of all time, if that's where you're getting at.
At this point, my girlfriend gets jealous when I talk about Jose Iglesias. We'll put it that way.
Nice. Okay, guys, we're gonna wrap up. We're just at about an even hour, so we didn't bore people with our 1 hour and 40 minute what we've had the last few times. I think it's good to be at about an hour, and hopefully we'll have another podcast in about 3 to 4 weeks to discuss what's going on with the rest of the season. That should be around the minor league all-star break, I would think.
And if I could just throw something in there, Michael Amonzar just went deep right on cue. So,
oh wow.
Moral of the story is that I'm an idiot.
There is one other thing. We do want to thank everyone that donated last year during the donation run. That made us able to have this southern trip, to have Chris go down to scout Greenville and Salem. Without your contributions, we wouldn't have been able to do that. So thank you very much. We may be having another one of those again in July, and hopefully we'll be expanding our scouting even further next year. So thanks again. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Jugger, 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 jugger